I'd just like to say a little about Ajahn Pasa. No, we've been friends for a very long time. I dare not say how many years, since we were both very much younger than we are now. That being said, Ajahn Pasa was raised in Manitoba in Canada. He studied history at the University of Winnipeg, and after graduating, he spent some time traveling in India and Thailand. In 1974, he became a Buddhist monk and started his training under the Venerable Ajahn Chah, who is one of the foremost meditation teachers in Thailand, I'd say, of the last century. He's since passed away. Last century meaning 20th century. We're not that old. In 1982, Ajahn Pasano was appointed abbot of Wat Nana Chat, which translated into English means the International Forest Monastery, and became a highly respected Dhamma teacher in Thailand, responsible for training of monks, novices, and also teaching lay people. In 1997, he moved to California to establish Abhayagiri Forest Monastery, of which he is currently the abbot. And it gives me really great pleasure and great honor to welcome Ajahn Pasano. And after he gives his talk, I'm sure that he will be happy to take questions, but maybe save your questions till he's done. And we will also take questions from people online. So thank you very much. Welcome, Tan Ajahn.
Okay. Years. Yes, it's delightful to have the opportunity to come here. This is the first time I've been to the Theosophical Society, and of course to have the opportunity to spend time with John. So that, as is often the case, teaching at a public venue, people will ask, what topic would you like to speak on? And what I usually say is just make something up and I'll talk about it. So that's what he did. So that in the little write-up, it's about the path of serenity and insight and the aspects of the Buddha's, the way that the Buddha laid out his teaching. And also that meditation forms an integral part to the Buddha's approach to spiritual practice and a spiritual training. And I think it's important to recognize that aspect of what the Buddha calls a training, because I think it's a really interesting approach to spirituality, and also that when the Buddha sometimes it's translated as training, so like the threefold training that is given as the path of freedom is a path of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom or discernment. And this word that is called a training is also just as easily translated as education. So that giving ourselves an education in learning how to not suffer or to not create complications, because that's when the Buddha lays out the purpose of his path. That purpose is, in his own words, that so often summarized as the freedom from suffering. And suffering is not a great word as a translation, but it's the workable word, that sometimes it's translated as discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, stress. But I think the main reason that the Buddha used this as a structure is that we tend to be a bit more motivated to do something when we want to get out of suffering. And so that the Buddha is really keen on pointing out the areas that we create problems, that we create difficulties, that we create a sense of dis-ease. Because when we are able to drop that, to let that go, then it, it always feels better to not suffer than to suffer. So it's actually a no-brainer. So the Buddha didn't really give much room for speculative philosophical questions too much. He really did focus on this sense that the purpose of his path was to be free from this quality of dis-ease, which of course opens the door to freedom, to liberation. And there's a very famous simile that he uses in that he said he compares it to and the Buddha was a warrior prince, so that some of his images are martial and military. So that he said it's just as if a warrior on the battlefield was shot by an arrow, and his mates come to help him out and want to take the arrow out, want to treat the wound, and the person says, "Wait, I want to know where that arrow came from. I want to know what kind of wood is on it. I want to know what kind of feathers are on the shell. I want to know what they made the arrowhead from. I want to know who shot that arrow. I want to know what caste that person who shot that arrow was from." And the Buddha said, "And what do you think?" By the time he got all those questions answered, would he not die before then? And he said, "Yes, he'd probably die before then." In exactly the same way that I teach just these truths that are for freedom from dis-ease, freedom from discontent, freedom from suffering. And I don't teach. And actually, that simile came about when a monk who was sitting and meditating and disgruntled, saying, I really want to know, about these, is the world finite or is it infinite? Is it permanent or is it, is it eternal or not eternal? Is the soul the same as the body, or is the soul different from the body, or is it some of it or none of it?" He never answers those questions. I'm going to go and tell that Buddha that if he doesn't answer those questions for me, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to disrobe. And so gets his courage up, goes in, and talks to the Buddha, lays it out for him straight. And of course the Buddha sort of says, "You foolish man. When I gave you ordination, did I ever tell you I was going to answer those questions? Was that a condition of you taking ordination, becoming a monk?" "No." He said, "Well, just as a warrior prince, if he were out on a battlefield," and then gave that simile. So the Buddha had a very clear plan. He wanted to give the tools to practice, to train, to educate ourselves in a way of living and perceiving ourselves and the world around us in a way that gives us the opportunity to kind of emancipate and liberate the heart. So that this path of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom is oftentimes, especially when it comes to the meditation aspect, is summarized into two different qualities of mind. And one is serenity and the other is insight, or tranquility and investigation, or peace and discernment. I mean, those kind of qualities. So that these are aspects of the mind that we need to cultivate with a sense of balance, in that we need to rely on the quality of stillness, of clarity, of tranquility, in the sense of the mind being very settled. And we also need to learn how to investigate. We need to question and to be able to discern clearly what is the true nature of our experience. What is the layering of our perceptions and assumptions and habits of and conditioning? Which doesn't mean that one tosses out one's habits or conditioning, but one has to know clearly how that works so that we're not just working on blind assumptions. So that this developing of these two qualities of mind, they go hand in hand, they go together. And one of the images that my teacher Ajahn Chah has used gives the comparison of the tranquility and serenity aspect being like a candle, but a candle that's not lit yet, so that it's got potential. But if you're in a dark room and all you've got is an unlit candle, then you're still going to be not so safe yet. And the aspect of insight or investigation is like a match. Say, on its own, you strike it, you've got light, but it doesn't have any staying power. It doesn't have fuel that allows it to last for very long. So that this mutual relying of serenity and insight are like striking the match and lighting the candle. So that flame that sort of comes out brightly for a short period has the opportunity to sustain itself. And then then one has a light that lasts for some time. So that sense of that mutual support and mutual relying on each other is this aspect of serenity and insight. So that we need to cultivate these together. And there's another image that the Buddha himself uses to kind of give an image of the need for these two qualities to work together. Is the forest, and there's this nice pool, and an elephant comes to the pool, and he wades into the pool, and he cools himself off, and he squirts water behind his ears, and he has a great time, and he eats the lotuses, and he's very refreshed, and then he goes out again. And then he said, there's a rabbit who watches this. He's by the pool, and he said, wow, that's really cool. I want to do that. I want to be like that. So this rabbit sort of jumps into this pool, thinking, oh, I'm going to cool myself down with the water, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But he's not as big as an elephant, and he drowns. He just can't do it. And the Buddha said it's similar, that somebody who hasn't developed especially the aspects of tranquility and stability of mind and a steady insight and a sense of contentment in tranquility. No one gets the idea that one would like to be like the elephant, but you've got to do the practice. You've got to put the effort in. You've got to build up that oomph in one's spiritual practice in order to see clearly, to understand, to be able to walk the talk. And that's really essential. So this aspect of practice and training is an essential part of the Buddha's path. And these aspects of developing the qualities of tranquility, serenity, and insight, there's actually many, many different styles of meditation that the Buddha taught. The Buddha himself didn't collate them and make a list of all of the different techniques, but later commentators have sort of read through the scriptures, read through the discourses, and came up with a list of about 40 different meditation techniques that the Buddha used. And the one that the Buddha himself taught the most often and praised the most was mindfulness of breathing, which is a fundamental, generic, boilerplate meditation technique. But then the Buddha laid it out in a very detailed way of how to cultivate the mindfulness of breathing. But he also taught other types of meditations that are both relying on devotion, faith, recollections of the Buddha himself, of the teachings of the Sangha, recollection of virtue, recollections of generosity. Some are more discursive recollections around impermanence, around the aspects of aging, sickness, death, and these are like sort of rousing meditations. Some are settling meditations like loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, recollections of peace. These are all either devotional or settling meditations. Some are specific concentration techniques, like using visual objects for absorbing into the object of meditation to allow the mind to become really firmly concentrated. So that there are many, many different techniques, but a lot of it is really dependent on whatever works. The Buddha was extremely practical, so that whatever works, whatever helps the mind to increase in wholesome tendencies and decrease in unwholesome tendencies, that works. That's a valid technique. And if one's doing a meditation and using a technique that sort of got seal of approval from this teacher, or has got this kind of hype from whatever lineage, but the mind itself, the heart, increases in unwholesome, unskillful tendencies and mental states and decreases in the wholesome, then it's not working. And so that one has to see for oneself, one has to check for oneself, one has to be able to learn how to use the tools skillfully. And there's a certain need or necessity to develop some skills with a few different meditation techniques, in the sense that the nature of the mind is such that with the best of intentions and as skillful as we can be, it's just so ordinary to just get bored with it, or the mind gets inured to a particular meditation technique and you lose the edge. And it's just ordinary. So then that's where one needs to skillfully come at the practice from a slightly different angle, so that one can be lifting up wholesome mental states and undermining the unwholesome. The sense of practicality. One of Ajahn Chah's teachers was a renowned and respected meditation master also. And his advice one time to Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah went asking for a technique, a method, and he just said, if the defilements and unwholesome tendencies come at you high, then you duck. And if they come at you low, then you jump over them. And this sense of, you got to figure it out. You got to learn how to use these tools, the techniques, the methods, and understand how to apply them. In terms of the aspects of insight, then the way that we view our experience is through the lens of characteristics which are universal. They're just looking at a universal characteristic. And the Buddha points to the universal characteristics of impermanence or change or uncertainty. All phenomena are permanent, they're changing. They're of a compounded nature, and therefore they're going to change. So that to be able to look at that, to look at it through the lens of, and investigate, to look at it through the lens of that quality of unsatisfactoriness, of dis-ease, of stress. Is there some stress in the system somehow? How to look at that, how to see that? And then the aspect of what is called the non-self nature, in the sense that if something was truly one's self, in the sense of being, it should be under one's power, so that if it were, and this is how the Buddha was, if it's not under one's power, then it really doesn't belong to you. And so that one has to see it, this is not myself, this is not self, this is a non-self characteristic. So that one can, looking at it from that sense, if one can't control it or claim ownership over it, then one has to let it be its own, its non-self nature. It's a part of nature. And it's just like, oftentimes you look at the human body and think, I say, do I have the power to say, you know, don't get old, don't get sick, don't change on me anymore. I've had enough of this change. I say, we can't do that. Even our minds, it's like, very first time that Ajahn Chah came to the West, he was in England, and this was at a Tibetan center, and somebody came to him and said, I've been meditating, I've been practicing, and I've got this real problem with anger, and I don't know what to do with this. Anger just flares up in my mind. I don't know what to do with it. And Ajahn Chah said, oh, that's easy. Next time you get angry, just sit down, get a clock, and time it for 2 hours, and you say, okay, I'm going to be angry for 2 hours, and I'm not going to let it change. I'm just going to keep this anger, and it's going to be like that. And see if you can do that. Rather than kind of brilliant in the sense that so often, oh, yeah, you've got a real problem. The anger's bad. You know, you've got to get rid of that. And then Ajahn Chah said, oh, yeah. Well, just try to get rid of it. As soon as you try and try to push the anger away, annihilate it, push it out, you can't do it. It's not yours to do that. This is a conditioned phenomena, and it's not one's true self by any means. So that to be able to make that really clear, these reflections or this avenue of investigation or education, training, looking at things through the lens of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, of not-self. These are, again, they're tools. They're tools to be able to direct the mind and direct the heart to a quality of dispassion, of disenchantment, of relinquishment, and being able to be able to put things down. Because we tend to, something comes up, and we hold on to it. We find it very difficult to actually put things down and let them follow their own course, their own nature. And of course, that's exactly why we suffer. So that is where Ajahn Chah sort of said, and I don't know how many times myself or John have heard it. So you say, there's only two things you need to do. Know clearly and let go. So this is just, that's the essence of a spiritual path, of a spiritual training. And learning how to know clearly and knowing how to let go, to relinquish, to release. Because the problem isn't one of knowledge. If I only had the right piece of knowledge, I'd be okay. If I just knew something in terms of information. I've got the wrong information. I need different information for my spiritual well-being. But it's more around actually just this quality of awareness and clarity and the ability to not hold tightly to things, not just let them go. So that this ability to develop that quality of serenity and insight are the tools that we have in order to facilitate our clarity and understanding, and that the aspect of insight into the Buddha's truths, are not necessarily just trying to get more information, but it's trying to get the clarity and a sense of the discernment. Remember Ajahn Chah one time saying that sometimes people with a lot of knowledge have difficulty practicing. So it's like in Thailand, when you collect mangoes, you've got a bamboo pole that has a little basket on the end, and you go up and you just hook the mangoes, and you bring them down. Because mangoes, if you leave them to ripen and drop on their own, they really get bruised, and they bruise really easily. So that you get them just right, you hook them, you bring them down. But this is where the balance of serenity and insight are needed, in the sense of these work together, so that, if your pole's too short, you can't reach it, so you don't get it. But if your pole's too long, like you've got too much knowledge, you can't get it either. You just have to get it right, just the right length of pole, and you'll be okay. So in the same way, that sense way, we develop these aspects of meditation, cultivating this quality of tranquility, of serenity, and understanding. And as I was saying, that these are tools that we're using. Because sometimes, you know, it can be taken as one of the central teachings around the aspect of suffering. And then these aspects of impermanence, of non-self. But these are skillful tools that allow for the heart to really cool, that sense of cooling. Even the word that is used for the goal of Buddhist practice, of nirvana or nibbana, literally means cooling. And it was a word that was actually used in a colloquial sense of the rice pot starts to boil and you take it off the fire and you set it down to nirvana to cool down. And of course, also a whole constellation of ideas and projections inevitably sort of grow around these words. But it's helpful to be able to go back to these original teachings and original sort of flavor of what's the Buddha pointing to. And if you're living in Chicago in the wintertime, maybe cooling isn't the greatest image to think of. If you're living in tropical India, cooling is really nice. That's where you get really comfortable. So one has to see how the teachings and the tools that the Buddha gives, what are they for? How does he use them? How to apply them? And a lot of what, when we speak of this path of practice, is learning how to use the tool skillfully so that one can experience this quality of increase of wholesome and decrease in the unwholesome. And how that's experienced is, you know, both on a psychological level or a spiritual level of increased clarity, increased happiness, increased sense of stability and well-being. There's a way that we can look at our experience that we can start to recognize, is this going in the right direction or not? How to develop that? And to gauge our practice, gauge our training, gauge our way of learning, because this word that we speak of in Buddhist training is also education, learning how to educate ourselves in a way that is really leading to peace. So many different methods and techniques. It's just learning how to use them. And it's like any good tradesman it's just learning how to use the tools. It's really helpful for people to, when you're taking on a spiritual path, to learn how to experiment with a few different methods and techniques of practice so that you get some skill in how to apply them. And then how to adjust to when the mind changes and one is either gets bored or lazy or kind of lacking in inspiration. And it's learning how to adjust that, learning how to bring up different things that help to inspire the mind or encourage ourselves. If you've got a job at your home that you call an electrician in to fix the electricity is out at your house, and you call an electrician. Electrician shows up, and all he's got is a screwdriver. It wouldn't inspire much confidence, and he might get it done, but he might not. So that, in the same way, spiritual practitioners and seekers learn how to develop a toolkit of training, of educating, of practicing, and these aspects of cultivation of serenity, tranquility, clarity. Stillness. It's a training of discernment, of reflection, of investigation, learning how to turn the mind in, not in a discursive way, a restlessly discursive way. We have to learn how to direct our attention and our investigation so that it's fruitful. And these two aspects are mutually supportive. And sometimes the investigative part comes forward, comes to the fore, And sometimes what is needed is the serenity or the tranquility aspect of the mind. Sometimes we just have to pay attention to settling, and turning the mind to stillness. And as we cultivate these two different aspects, they are mutually supportive. And we use the different aspects of this training in the same way that you go to a restaurant or a buffet or something, and you're going to see there's going to be these different foods. And some of them are going to be attractive, but not so good for you. And then some of them are going to be, you know, one's going to be drawn to them because they nourish you. And some are going to be, not so interested in that. So one has to really encourage oneself in a way that one's nourishing and nurturing one's own health and well-being with the kind of foods that really are good for you. So in the same way with our spiritual practice and our cultivation, cultivating these different methods, techniques, aspects of a spiritual path so that they really do nurture our well-being, our understanding, and bring us peace. So I'll offer that for reflection. I've talked, I think, long enough, and if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Venerable Sir. If you do have questions, and I'm sure there will be questions, wait till I bring the microphone to you so that we can record the question as well as the answer. And if we have questions from people online, I'll...
Hi. What's your definition of enlightenment?
Working definition is always freedom from suffering. And that... just echoing the Buddha's way of defining, because it's a helpful way of viewing experience. Because sometimes, happiness, that kind of changes sometimes, or, sometimes even, special knowledges or charisma or, whatever. All these things are qualities that many people embody and carry. But to be able to track back and sort of see, is there still any vestige of discontent, dis-ease, stress? And that's what the Buddha is. Because what it does, obviously the Buddha thought that as well. It's a very skillful tool for being able to highlight any areas where we're making assumptions, or especially wrong assumptions, because usually when we make a wrong assumption of something, then it'll come back and bite us, and we'll tend to be affected in an uncomfortable way. So it's a really good working definition in terms of practical nature.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the no self or emptiness of the mind?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question in the sense of the, no self or emptiness of the mind, because oftentimes that's how it's interpreted or presented. And when one goes back to the, and even in, many Buddhist circles. But when one goes back to the way that the Buddha himself presented, say, emptiness, it's not a metaphysical quality. It's a working tool. That is, it's always sort of emptiness of something. So there's a discourse where the Buddha is talking about emptiness, and he goes through these different areas of emptiness, but it's always empty of something, like this. If this room were empty of people, it would be there would be an emptiness. And then going through the aspects of refinement of mind, and then that being an emptiness of an experience where one was previously grasping, and then the emptiness of self is the emptiness of an assumption of solidity and kind of essence that is constant and eternal. And the Buddha said, maybe not. And maybe it's more helpful to look at it through the lens of not-self and not as a metaphysical or speculative take on religious experience, but a skillful way of being able to turn to relinquishment and freedom.
How would that be different than an intense concentration or a visualization?
Oh, okay. That's very helpful. Because the concentration is dependent on being able to hold that construct in mind, to be able to overlay the experience with a state of peace or tranquility. And the way that the Buddha uses it is using the tranquility as a tool for a holding and viewing experience, and then so that it comes to a place of relinquishment and release, as opposed to holding. Because if one has to hold a well-being in the mind through concentration or through tranquility alone, then as soon as what the conditions for that tranquility aren't there, then the mind is shaken again. Whereas an insight into the true nature of things, or an insight into spiritual truth, is something that you can carry around with you. It's not going to be shaken by, say, the conditions that allowed that tranquility and concentration to be there. It's not going to be shaken by that. One of the images that is sometimes used in the Thai forest tradition is if one takes a rock and puts it on top of grass, then the grass is not going to grow. But as soon as you take that rock off, grass is going to come back. That grass not coming up from there is dependent on the concentration, the weight of that force of peace and tranquility, that it comes from concentration. What one needs to do is to dig up that grass and take those roots out, and then you're going to have this patch where the grass is not going to come back. So that's using insight. So one is using the tranquility to shine a light on the mind, because there is a purification of mind that comes through seeing clearly, seeing things in their true nature. Tim was back there with his hand up.
My question was about Ajahn Chah. You did study with him, and what is it that you would say made him the, as John said, the greatest meditation teacher of the in the past century? What qualities?
Well, probably our bias that we're that we're students of his. but besides that, I think one of the things that is unique was his ability to be, say, a leader and teacher without it being a personal attainment or position, so that one never felt that he had anything invested in it. And also how he passed on his teaching was not through personal charisma, or although he was charismatic, but it was through the vehicle of sangha, of community. He really empowered the community, so both the monastic community and the lay communities. And he was always finding ways for him to be able to step back personally and then encourage and nurture the wisdom of the group, or the wisdom of the community, of others. So that was, to me, is the most striking. Other aspects of his personality were somewhat unique. He was very skilled in being able to take a complicated teaching and express it in a simple, straightforward way. He was able to be somebody who one always felt that he had your best interests at heart. And when he came to, he only came to America once, and he gave led a retreat on the East Coast. And there were some young Buddhist teachers there. And at the end of the retreat, he said, if you're going to be bringing Buddhism to the West, to America, you've got to be able to teach in a way that goes against the grain to some extent and pierces the heart. And that he was always willing to do that, which made him exasperating to live with sometimes. But one always felt he had your best interests at heart. Sometimes he didn't make things convenient or comfortable for you, but one could see the habits of mind that so easily come up. And so, you know, those are characteristics, I think, that are quite unique. And he actually, his teaching career ended when he was about 63. And then the last almost 10 years of his life, he was completely bedridden with increasing inability to motor capacity and speech were lost. And he's died in 1992. So it's like he hasn't taught for 30 years, but there's still his sort of, there's a very vibrant community where his monasteries, there's probably 300 branch monasteries associated with him, and then all the ones in the West, which are probably getting close to about 15 or 20 now. So that's an impact that's quite unique. Because I'm 63 this year, and I'm thinking, wow, Ajahn Chah did everything by what my age is now. It just boggles my mind.
Someone over here had a question, yes?
Yeah, right here.
Thank you for your teaching this evening. My question is what guidance you might have for a sangha of lay practitioners who have been together for 2 or 3 years that use chiefly as their instruction the reading and discussion of the books of Buddhist masters, mm-hmm. and how that sangha, our sangha, might kind of, I guess, maintain and improve spiritual progress, mm-hmm. what kind of practice. And
yeah. Well, I would encourage a broad kind of implementation of the path, in the sense of, rather than it being just a meditation group, that it's sort of like a Buddhist path book, group, really learning how to develop a group sensibility and interest in the different aspects of a Buddhist training, qualities of in a traditional Buddhist society, generosity plays a huge role in how we live together. Generosity, virtue, kindness, these are easily get overlooked in the kind of looking for the meditation that's going to make us peaceful. But it's the cultivation of the whole path that sort of everything comes up at the same time. And then with in terms of different teachers, different masters, just taking it as a that's really good in terms of, but again, sort of recognizing as a group question, what is it that helps us as a group progress in wholesome qualities and decrease in the unwholesome? So so rather than getting too caught up in the refinements of either a meditation technique or a philosophical query of some sort. But you know, what is it that really helps that general sense of well-being and clarity to increase? Because that's the actual trigger that we're able to help us grow in this path. Also, there's a teaching in the scriptures that is oftentimes quoted for when we speak about the benefits of having good spiritual friends. There's a very well-known discourse where the Buddha's attendant and cousin Ananda is in the forest on retreat meditating, and he has this kind of really strong insight, and then he goes back to see the Buddha in the evening, and you know, wow, I had this really great insight today that half of the holy life is having good spiritual friends. And then the Buddha sort of said, oh, don't say that, Ananda. He said, it's not half the holy life, it's the whole of the holy life to have good spiritual friends. But usually people sort of stop there in the passing on of the story, or even when it's taught sometimes. But the Buddha actually goes on to say, and what is it to have good spiritual friends? And then he goes, then he turns to the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, is sort of so that one drawing close to this path of practice, of virtue, of meditation, of discernment. But then he also refines it again, and sort of that each quality, as we develop these, each aspect of the path, to be each quality, needs to be using the aspect of a sense of solitude, or kind of solitude, but it's not just a physical solitude. It's like an ability to step back from things. So that, applying that to each aspect of the path, applying dispassion, applying a sense of attention to cessation, the ending of things, and to relinquishment, particularly a relinquishment of kind of a selfishness, or any kind of selfish tendency. So these are each quality of the path, and so that's how we become a good spiritual friend to ourselves and to others. So that we rely on others who are like-minded and draw close to each other to encourage ourselves. And that's one of the reasons we live in a monastery, certainly for me, and one of the benefits of living in a monastery is that it's very rare to find a monastery where everybody is lazy, depressed, and miserable at the same time. You know, we help to encourage each other. So that there is that sense of sangha, being community and helping each other and being there for each other. But then it's also paying attention to those inner qualities that help one to be a good spiritual friend to oneself, and then a good spiritual friend to others.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I was wondering if you have any suggestions for a layperson trying to maintain that sense of tranquility and the sort of open inquisitiveness in the daily life, mm-hmm. when you're not with your sangha and you're not on the cushion.
Right. Which is most of the time. One of the ways and I'll use a couple images that Ajahn Chah used, and examples that I think are useful. A lot of it's around perception. So that there's one occasion when the first time that Ajahn Chah went to England, and he was staying at a Buddhist center that was in the end offered to the to Ajahn Chah and our Sangha to begin the establishing of a monastery in England. And it was in the northern part of London on a main thoroughfare with a pub just sort of kind of kitty corner across the street. And because it was kind of one night when it was a bit warm, so they opened the windows. Friday night, sounds of the pub coming across, and so they had the meditation and then the talk, and then right after, you know, open it up for questions. And first question is, you know, what do we do when sounds come and disturb the meditation, disturb our practice? And Ajahn Chah's answer was, sounds don't come to disturb you. You go and disturb the sounds. So that perception of that we get impinged on, that we get that we are pulled out because of this, because of that, but we tend to abdicate responsibility in that way, and we don't recognize how it's our own aversion or irritation or our own desire or confusion, that it's us going out to that world. So then that sense of taking responsibility and recognizing, okay, because it isn't also trying to force the mind to be in the ideal state of not being disturbed by anything, but it's recognizing how it works, understanding how it works, understanding the effect that happens. And this is where that whole aspect of disenchantment and relinquishment are so important, because it's not a pushing away of experience, but it's sort of like having seen it so clearly that one makes a choice and say, no, I'd rather be peaceful than upset. I'd rather be clear than distracted. So that's carrying that kind of training with us. And there's another time when a Western monk was at Ajahn Chah's monastery, and in the area where the ordination hall is, he was given some very big stones that were ancient from the time of the Khmer Empire, and very, very big, probably 8-10 feet tall, and these big, they're carved into these sort of somewhat shapes, and Ajahn Chah asked this monk, just walking past, casual question. Think this rock's heavy? And he said, oh yeah, it's heavy. He says, not if you don't pick it up. That's, you know, again, that sort of saying, okay, yeah. Do I really need to pick this up? The answer is, you know, whether it's, you know, that there's some kind of something really exciting and fascinating, or something that's irritating and frustrating, as in, do I really need to pick it up? So those are the kind of things we can carry with us. And again, training isn't trying to live by the ideal of never picking anything up. It's starting to understand the mind and its habits and what it does and the effect, not picking a lot up.
No other question from the audience live? No other questions from the audience virtual? Venerable, could you maybe... Many of the people here, Dalton, obviously it's the first time they've met you. Maybe just tell them a little bit about the monastery where you live, so that if they ever head out west and they're in that area, maybe they can visit.
Yes, certainly. So I live at the Bhaiagiri Buddhist Monastery. It's about 2.5 hours north of San Francisco, It's in Mendocino County, which is very beautiful. Hills, forests. We've got 280 acres of land. Makes it a wonderful place for a monastery. We've got facilities for guests to come and stay, both men and women. There is almost always a waiting list, so that if anybody is interested in coming out and staying or visiting, let us know ahead of time and try to figure out when's a good time. The community was established about, it was 1996 in June, and so we've been there about 16 years, and we started with pretty much nothing, and slowly building up the physical amenities and then also the actual community itself, and so that we've got right at in this very moment we've got 14 monks, one novice, couple postulants in training. There are two long-term lay women who are there, and then anywhere between 4 or 5 to 8 or 10 lay people staying for shorter or longer periods of time, so that it's set up as a forest monastery. So that's there's in the Thai tradition. There are monasteries that are in the towns and the cities that tend to focus more on ceremony, ritual, study, academics. And there are forest monasteries that tend to focus more on simplicity of lifestyle and focus on meditation. So that we try to follow the forest monastery model. And dwelling places are kind of scattered all through the forest because there's hardly any flat land on our monastery. So that trying to find a flat enough spot to put a 120 square foot hut is actually difficult. But once you finally figure out where you can put things and you actually build them, it lends itself to a lot of solitude and a sense of really being in nature. It's a very beautiful monastery. I'm biased, but most people would concur. There's a small local community sort of developing, people moving to be close to there. Not so many. For some reason, the land prices, it's expensive in California. So it's not that easy for people to relocate there. We sort of got there just as the kind of the land market was going crazy. So for some reason, even with the bubble bursting in many areas in California, still in that where we are, it hasn't really gone down. Hasn't gone down that much. So, but there's still a small group of people who are sort of a lay community growing around the monastery.
And before all these good people are tempted to rush over to that very beautiful monastery, Venerable, so maybe you should tell them what would be expected of them. What are the practices?
Yes, well, you can look it up on the website. You're keeping simplicity of lifestyle so that keeping 8 precepts if you're living in the monastery, which means not eating in the evening, and then are also participating in the. It isn't that people come on retreat there. It's that, I mean, it is a sort of retreat, but it's also that people come to participate in the lifestyle, and so that people would join in morning chanting meditation, evening chanting meditation. In the morning time, we have a communal chores, work. So we work together, and people do all sorts of, you know, some people will be work in the kitchen, some people be in the office, some people be doing trail work, some people doing maintenance, so that everybody has a task, a duty, and helping out with that. The afternoons are open for people to meditate or study as they wish. There's time in the late afternoon. We come together about 5:30 for kind of informal tea times. That's a time when anybody can come and ask questions. So try to get a balance of communal things and a balance of solitude, so that people have time to be on their own, but then also learn how to live together in community, which has been a theme of the establishing of the monastery, to how to give that encouragement to solitude and also how to learn the skills of living together as human beings, which, you know, the world would be a very peaceful place if these pesky humans weren't around. We sort of grate up against each other.
Well, thank you very much, Venerable, for the instructions and the inspiration of your presence. And also for our guest monks, thank you very much for coming this evening. Living embodiments that remind us that there's more to life than just a material quest.